the wenches dawdle in such dresses they are used to wear.
This is Jim Carroll, and you're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Music as uncensored as it could get these days.
Good afternoon. It's May 6th, 2026. I'm T. Hetzel, and you've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. As always, the program you are about to hear features the views of myself and my guest and do not reflect the station's nor the views of the University Regents. Today, we return to the archives to a conversation in 2017 with Derek Peterson after he won the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship Genius Grant. Dr. Peterson, the Ali Missouri Collegiate Professor of History and African Studies, is a historian of Eastern Africa's intellectual cultures. Derek Peterson, as faculty member and as outgoing chair of the Senate Committee on University Affairs, gave an address at UM's 2026 spring commencement. And now I'll quote from a community advocate's email about his address. Dr. Peterson shared what he found in the archives to impart a lesson to graduating students about members of the University of Michigan community with the moral courage who refused to accept the enclosures and orthodoxies of their time. End quote. I think to recognize this courage and to embody this courage is the work and the challenge of such a place of learning and opportunity as the University of Michigan. Thanks for tuning in today and for being here. I hope you enjoy today's episode from the archives with Dr. Derek Peterson.
Thank you.
I've got living writers. I'm T. Hetzel. And today, let's see, I should also say you're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And today on the program, I'm so happy to have Derek Peterson here in the studio with me. Derek, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
We've got your books on the table here. We've got creative writing, translation, bookkeeping, and the work of imagination in colonial Kenya, 2004, and ethnic patriotism and the East African revival. A History of Dissent, 1935 to 1970.
Terrible, terrible title, I have to say. It's one of these titles that was created to allow search algorithms to find the book on Amazon. But titles, the art of a good title has completely gone out the window in the past, you know, 10 or 15 years as the internet has transformed titling altogether. But so that title is awful.
What was the title that you would want to have on here? Like, what was, like...
So the book is about this, it's about the history of this movement called the East African Revival, whose converts read a book by John Bunyan, the 1600s English writer, Pilgrim's Progress, very closely and intently in their own vernacular languages. So the title of the book was going to be fantastic. It would have sort of leapt off the shelves. It was going to be The Pilgrim's Politics. But as soon as I ran that title past my editor, the response was, no, that will never work. People will think it's about Thanksgiving, you know, this sort of thing. Not the
really?
Right thing. Yes. So I ended up with this very long and boring title.
But even though, because that's great. They should have listened to you because you
should
have had,
yes.
You know, Pilgrim's Politics and then, you know, the good old colon.
Right.
And more.
Yes,
right.
Right. Colons have disappeared from book titles. It's a troubling problem.
Let's bring it back.
Exactly.
Bringing back the colon.
There you are.
And semicolons aren't bad either.
Right. Yes. Right.
Well, let's see. Before we go too far into the show, because thanks for picking out the music for today too, Derek.
Sure. Pleasure.
Appreciate it. We wanted to do a shout out to longtime listener Harry out there listening. Harry, thanks for calling in to say hi, and we appreciate you. So thanks for listening. Okay, so the biography here, short bio of Derek R. Peterson. Derek R. Peterson is professor in the History Department and the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. His early scholarly work was about the history of African language literature in Kenya. Later, he wrote a prize-winning book about the East African Revival, a Christian conversion movement that challenged cultural nationalists' control over civic life. With funding from the American Council of Learned Societies and the National Endowment for the Humanities, he is currently working on a new book about the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin. In 2016, Peterson was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship in African Studies and elected Fellow of the British Academy. In 2017, he was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship. So that brings us up to this moment.
Yeah. Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it does. Hey, congratulations,
well,
by the way.
Thanks.
Has that changed anything with work? Because you have been, I mean, to be honest, you have been winning awards and funding and grants along the way for your scholarship.
No, the University of Michigan's been extremely generous in helping me do things that I wanted to do outside sort of the formal domain of scholarship.
And you came in 2009, Derek?
I came in 2009. There's a new African Studies Center that was founded the year before I got here. And the African Studies Center has allowed me and a number of other people to do really interesting and exciting things in kind of the field of the public humanities, archive preservation, music research, radio work, and other such things that you can't do if you have only a university salary to work with. So, you know, the MacArthur funding lets me do things that Michigan won't pay for. So, you know, I'll be able to bring in next semester a museum curator from Uganda, who I'm working with to design new exhibitions in the Uganda Museum. He'll come to Ann Arbor for a couple of months. I can pay for that with MacArthur money. But I couldn't have paid for it with Michigan money because of the way the funding works. Anyway, so, you know, it opens up a budget a bit more widely. It lets me kind of think of interesting and creative things to do. But already Michigan has been a fantastic place to get kind of cool stuff going in the field of African studies because of the way the African Studies Center has been supported and enabled by our administration to kind of let scholars pursue ambitions that are outside the formal domain of scholarship, as I said.
And can you tell us more about the African Studies Center, like where it is on campus? Like, is it?
Yeah.
Is it? Forgive me, because I know, is it a place?
Well,
or is it an idea where where everyone can come?
It's a place and an idea.
Okay.
Like all good institutions, it has a reputation and a set of loyalties that structure how people are involved in it. It is kind of a place, you know, the physical footprint of all university departments is always contingent on funding. So, you know, right now it's in a newly refurbished building, Weiser Hall, as it's called, over on the other side of campus on the fifth floor. There's a couple of offices. But really, the African Studies Center resides in the hearts of all Africa scholars and all African students at the university. It's an idea that holds that, you know, Africa, look, unlike other domains of scholarship, African studies inspires loyalty among those of us who pursue it because of the, you know, the enjoyments of research, because of our loyalty to the places that we study, because of the difficulties that students from Africa and scholars of Africa confront as we try to produce scholarly work about the place. In that sense, there's a kind of camaraderie and shared devotion to the project of advancing the study of Africa that gives U of M African studies, you know, a kind of ambition and direction and enthusiasm that I think perhaps other area studies projects might not experience in such great depth.
Right. So camaraderie, a community.
Yeah. Forged in the context of difficulty and constraint, really.
Yeah.
And also in the context of kind of a profound sense of, you know, indebtedness to the people that we study. Like, if we're going to go and work with people who dedicate their time and energy to advancing our own work, then we ought to in turn do what we can do to help open resources in the global north to universities and colleagues in the global south who can benefit from such alliances. That's what the African Studies Center is meant to do, open up the doors of Ann Arbor to students from here and, you know, scholars and colleagues and co-travelers in African contexts who can develop collaborations and shared research projects that draw Ann Arbor together with different African institutions and universities.
And is there something coming up soon that we could tell everyone about, that like a program that's on deck or
An
event?
Well, the 10th anniversary of the African Studies Center.
Oh, wow, perfect.
Yeah, there we are. There's going to be a program of activity that's just now being planned, so it's a good time. Mid-March, March 15th, 16th, and 17th, there will be a program of lectures and seminars and such that will kind of call attention to the work that we've been doing in this domain over the past 10 years. It's being put together by Kelly Askew, who's the director, the founding director of the center, and it will be a very good occasion. So more to come.
Oh,
on that score.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah. So keep me posted, because
sure.
We'll let everyone know. Okay, well, let's take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll talk more today with Derek Peterson. You're listening to Living Writers. We've got Steph behind the glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
Yeah.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. Today on the program, Derek Peterson is here. So we started off the program. Thanks for choosing the Mingus, too, for today. In a way, we could just listen. listen. Get carried away into the music. So we started off the program, and you were so funny, Derek, because you were saying about the title of your book, Ethnic Patriotism. Well, let's just call it Pilgrim's Politics.
There we go.
but your first book, Creative Writing, I love that as a title. So that one you did have, because also it's not what you're necessarily going to expect, because you have a different definition for this title, Creative Writing, Translation, Bookkeeping, and the Work of Imagination in Colonial Kenya.
Yeah, that book got shelved under how-to manuals in the Library of Congress classification.
Oh, no.
It's there along with, you know, how to write an essay and how to, you know, this sort of thing, write characters, that sort of thing. So
it really did get lost. Like, we weren't joking about the titling.
Titling is a whole rat's nest for anybody who works in the field of the social sciences or humanities. But yeah, that book's about it. I guess, you know, I was glad that it ended up being in the place where it is in the library, in the hopes that people who work as creative writers might possibly find inspiration from it and a kind of sense of orientation and historicity about what they do. The book's about, it's now 15 years old, but it's about how in central Kenya, people who wrote in the language of the place, it's called Kikuyu, developed new ways of writing and speaking in their own vernacular languages over the course of 100 years. So the argument basically is to say that languages change in response to people's efforts to say new things in their language.
And to think new things.
And to think new things. As new politics become thinkable, so too do languages expand or contract and take different directions. So it's a kind of, you know, it's a book that takes language change as a kind of subject of political history, basically.
This is an aside note, and then we'll jump back to the book. But do you think that our current language, like American English, is contracting at the moment?
It's certainly heading in different directions than, you know, might have been the case in all of the shortening and contracting, as you say, of Twitter, new vehicles for communicating emotions, these emoticons, which I don't fully understand, but, you know, they're there and they're available to communicate things that had previously been only available in face-to-face communication, or perhaps, you know, marginalia has always been part of textual communication. So I don't know. I'd have to think through that more fully. But it certainly feels as though there's a kind of, you know, a missing element of language today in a world in which everything's being compressed by the technologies with which we work.
And it also seems like in the way, I almost feel like the word amazing has been taken away from me. Sometimes it's like overused, like everything is amazing and beautiful. And whereas the ideas aren't actually articulated, there's just some sort of trumped up positive like frame around them too, that in the realm of politics in some ways.
Yeah.
I wonder about that, the disappearing, like the challenge to actually articulate your ideas clearly.
Well, look, I mean, all linguistic communication relies on a certain amount of self-advertising and self-inflation in order to make words stick. These are the preoccupations of any speaker of any language, to find ways of, you know, making yourself listenable, of commanding an audience. So there's always been, not least in African languages, a kind of inflationary aspect to oral communication that goes with an effort to command an audience. This is what scholars who work in this field called addressivity, the ability to get people to listen to you, to hail an audience. Kikuyu people in central Kenya used a word called aterere to command an audience prior to the advent of print. Aterere means, hey, pay attention, you know, listen to me. Kikuyu people didn't have kings, they didn't have chiefs or full-time rulers. Aterere was the word that people who wanted to command an audience and a following used to get other people within an oral community to attend to what they said. What's interesting is that that word makes its way into print in the 20th century and becomes a vehicle by which the first generation and later writers of the Kikuyu language used to get oral print audiences likewise to attend to what was on the page. One of the earliest newspapers published in the Kikuyu language was aterere, that same word that had earlier connoted, you know, the attending that one was obliged to show in oral audiences. So, you know, again, amazing is a species of inflation that all languages pursue.
Right, right. Right. And so you went to Kenya as a graduate student.
Yeah.
Then
right.
Is this how did could you go back maybe go back and tell us your connection, like how this happened, how you began to pursue this, how this became such a part of your heart that you.
Well, I had the good fortune of having a Fulbright grant right after I finished my undergraduate degree. And that took me off to Kenya for a year. Fulbrights are amazing. Any undergraduates listening to this program should apply for a Fulbright to go to some exciting place because, assuming the funding line is still there in this new budget, who knows how that will turn out. But, you know, the J. William Fulbright Fund opens up opportunities for hundreds of American students every year to go off to unlikely places around the world and to basically do interesting things. It's unlike Peace Corps. In that, in the Peace Corps, you're obliged to do philanthropic work of some kind, sometimes poorly conceived, sometimes well conceived. Fulbright is meant to be a kind of scholarly undertaking, promoting cultural understanding, but also grounded in a kind of scholarly project. And for me, the Fulbright was a fantastic way to get into the life of the mind. I used my Fulbright funds to study Swahili language, which is the regional language of East Africa, and Kikuyu. And indeed, the book that you were just talking about, Creative Writing, grew out of my efforts to understand Kikuyu language. I was studying Kikuyu in an Anglican church language school in Nairobi. I was so taken with the way in which the language seemed to change over time as I consulted different dictionaries that I became interested in language change itself as a subject of scholarly research. So for me, Fulbright opened the door, and the experience of learning languages opened the door to a much wider set of preoccupations to do with how people think and how the changing architecture of intellectual life helps inform human culture more generally.
Changing architecture.
Yeah, I've become increasingly interested in media, infrastructure, the things that uphold public culture. Those are the preoccupations that are now guiding my own work and indeed shaped the way that I wrote that first book as well. Yeah.
So maybe then moving forward in time, your current work is centering around Uganda.
Yeah.
And Idi Amin and maybe also part of it's radio.
That's right. Yeah. No, I, in the past 10 years, more or less, I've been working on a project about the Uganda dictator Idi Amin. I don't know how many of your listeners will remember Idi Amin. In his own time, he was notorious.
Fearsome, really.
Fearsome character who, you know, stalked the imaginations of Europeans and Americans with images of African savagery and brutality. He was his own best propagandist. He kept a very close eye on what was said about him in the international press.
So he was a myth maker for himself and had an agenda to shape the press.
Indeed, yeah. A few years ago, some students from Michigan worked with some students from Makedede and with me to catalog the National Archives of Uganda in the basement of the archive in a room at the end of a long corridor of rooms in a lightless chamber. We found boxes and boxes full of press clippings that had been assembled by Idi Amin's press bureau in the 1970s with notations describing mentions of Idi Amin, even in local newspapers published in the United States. It seems as though
they just scanned the world press.
Exactly, looking for material that referenced the Amin administration, which they would clip and then put into a file for Amin to look at. He was very, very much interested in his own image abroad and was quite keen to get a particular kind of persona projected into the public domain internationally as much as locally within Uganda's politics.
Yeah. For his own ends in that way. So what was his story? Because he was a soldier and then a general.
Yeah.
And then the coup. But was he... I don't know.
You've kind of gone through it there. He was a soldier in the King's African Rifles, which was the British Army of colonial East Africa. After Ugandan independence in 1962, he became one of the senior ranking officers in the Uganda Rifles, as it was then called, later the Uganda Army. In 1966, he became the commander of the Uganda Army. And formed a very close relationship with the president at that time. His name was Milton Obote, Uganda's first president after independence. Amin and Obote, cohabited, as it were, in a kind of uneasy alliance from through the late 60s up to 25th of January 1971, when Amin took the opportunity of President Obote's trip to Singapore for a conference. While Obote was in Singapore, Amin organizes a coup, goes on the air on Radio Uganda, and makes an announcement about how he'd been called to serve by the Uganda army in the interest of the Ugandan Republic to overthrow the dictator Obote and to inaugurate a new era of freedom and black political empowerment in East Africa. And that was 25th January 1971 was the starting point of this cultural and political program that made up the Amin government. It's the subject of my book.
And in the book that you're currently writing.
That's right. Yeah.
And does that have a working title that you have made?
Not yet. For reasons I've referred to earlier, I have been unable to figure out a title. Perhaps one of your intrepid listeners will come up with something for me.
But and this book so far, it's been 10 years in the research.
Yeah.
And so it started, this project started because you were in these hallways and you found doing part of this larger archival work that you've been digitizing archives and preserving the archives, and you happen to find these boxes, and that's what sparked it.
Look, the Uganda government hasn't, until 2016, hasn't had capacity to deal with local government archives. Local government in Uganda means county level or municipal level government papers. And so all over Uganda, in local municipal buildings and in district-level buildings, there are piles and piles of paperwork that have been kept in a variety of poor states of preservation. So for the past 10 years, I've been working with colleagues from Mountains of the Moon University out in western Uganda to organize and digitize and make accessible district-level archives around the country. And it's been very successful. We've used little pots of money from Michigan, from the Center for Research Libraries in Chicago, and from other universities to create a digital archive now that consists of around 500,000 scans, which is the biggest digital repository of government documents in Africa. It's housed now at Mountains of the Moon University.
What a great sounding university, I would just like to say. It sounds like a wonderful place.
No, it's kind of got this mythic quality.
It does.
off to the west of the university is the Mountains of the Moon, as they're called, the Rwenzori Mountains on the Congo border. And they kind of loom over the town with this imposing, shadowy presence that you can see whenever you go outside. It's lovely. It's like, Uganda has this topographic and environmental context, it's not unlike Switzerland, this dramatic, shifts in altitude and politics that that make it an extraordinarily complicated and interesting place to live and work in because of the great variety of human cultures and outlooks on life that proliferate among people who live in such dramatically different environmental conditions.
Right.
Yeah. So Mountains of the Moon University there in the foothills of the Rwenzori is the place where we've been doing this archival work. And as I mentioned, it's that archival work, these district-level archives that have given me the material by which to write this book about Idi Amin. It's about, effectively, the experience of living under the Amin government. It's an effort to sort of center the experience of bureaucrats and museum curators and radio technicians and other folks who made the Amin state function in a time in which violence and precarity and austerity were very much the norm in public life.
Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. We'll talk more. Today on the program, Derek Peterson is here. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
São Vicente, nasce alegria, nasce sabura. Vanta put fazide, snakarna malara maxa, jam conchia san vicente, nas alegria nasce sabura, vanta put fazide, snakarna malara maxa. San Vicente é Brasilinho, cheio de alegria, cheio de cor. Nesses dias de loucura, catinguerra e carnaval, nesse mora benção sem igual. São Vicente é Brasilinho, cheio de alegria, cheio de cor. Nesses dias de loucura, catinguerra e carnaval, nesse mora benção sem igual. Não tem um festinha mais sossego, da Luisita vou poder entrar. Qualquer bafaca tá faltando, hoje é dia de carnaval. Não tem um pistinha mais sossego, da Luisita vou poder entrar. Qualquer bafaca tá faltando, hoje é dia de carnaval.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Derek Peterson is here. Michigan's own Derek Peterson. And thanks again for picking the music. That one was a great one. That was
Cesaria Evora, the great Cape Verdean singer, singing about the carnival in one of the islands of Cape Verde, São Vicente.
How much time are you able to spend on the continent of Africa? Like in, you know, what's that like in your life map so far?
Well, I mean, one has more time, anybody who's a scholar or a student has more time when you're actually a student to relax and spend time in a place that you're interested in. As you become older, obligations tie you closer to home. So when I was younger, I lived in Kenya for 2 years in the company of my wife. Since you know, I got my PhD in 2000, it's been a more rapid fire set of relationships. Until 7 years ago, I spent more or less 2 or 3 months every year in East Africa, occasionally more time as I had sabbatical leave. 7 years ago, I had a baby, and so my obligations now are largely here. I still am able to spend time, usually something like a month or a month and a half in Uganda these days, depending on the obligations I have here at home.
And when you go, is it focused largely on seeing how the preservation of the archives is going? Because it sounds like you're organizing many students from, let's see, like from African institutions as well as the University of Michigan, even.
Yeah, no, one of the lovely things about becoming a bit further along in my career is that you can think about different media and different forums and different institutions that one can work with, that you can work with as a scholar. So as I've already described, I've been working with this university in the west of Uganda to digitize government archives. A couple of years ago, I got stuck in with the Uganda Museum, which is a public museum in Kampala that was built. The building was put up in 1958. The collection was built over the course of the first half of the 20th century. The installation of the building went hand in hand with the development of museum displays, which haven't really been changed since the early 1960s. There's been efforts around the edges to transform little parts of the museum.
So it's like a museum of a museum.
Yeah. Everything is very, kind of displayed in a way that evokes a mid-20th century museum curatorial practice. So myself and the curator of the museum, the ethnographic curator of the museum, who's a lovely man named Nelson Abiti, have been working with Ugandan colleagues and students to develop plans for a new national history gallery, which would involve the renovation of the old part of the museum and perhaps also a new building where it might be possible to talk about the second half of the 20th century as a subject of historical and sort of, you know, cultural reflection. So we've got in mind a whole bunch of special displays that we think will eventually feed into a plan for a national history gallery that can sort of re-enliven this otherwise kind of dated set of displays.
Yeah. It does seem like you need to have time there on the ground, really.
Yeah, that's right.
For these projects. Mm. Yeah. But you also need to be somewhere where you're writing because you've got this work in progress, this book. How many chapters are you envisioning this, because it looks like we've got three of the book chapters here on the table with us. Do you have a sense of the shape of the project, or is it big? So ongoing.
I think it's probably about 2/3 done. It's going to be, I think, 10 chapters. I'm trying to write it as a book that will appear in Barnes and Noble and perhaps in airports. That is, I think it's important that Africa scholars would find a way to address audiences that are bigger than scholarly communities. The deficit of knowledge about African cultural and political history in the United States is really profound. And, you know, there's a lot of work that one can do as a teacher in the classroom, but I sort of feel an obligation at this stage in my career to find a way to talk to audiences that are never going to come into my university classroom, but that I can engage perhaps through a book that would use Idi Amin and his notoriety as a sales strategy, frankly, to tell a story about kind of the cultural politics and the experience of ordinary Ugandans living in circumstances of danger and constraint, but who nonetheless are engaged in high-minded, creative, and meaningful work, even in dangerous times. That's kind of the theme of the book. I'm trying to bring to light ordinary Ugandans' efforts to make meaning out of the lives that they live in times of danger and constraint. Yeah. I think I've just decided that's what the book's about.
Brilliant. Well, and that ties back to your early book, Creative Writing, where you're actually looking at the stories and the language changes, but looking closely at the people's language, not what was the... don't take this the wrong way as a history professor, but sometimes some of what we are told from history isn't the story of the people, aren't the narratives of the people.
Yeah, I mean, look, this, you know, African affairs intrude upon American consciousness when there's a disaster. Or alternately, when there are uplifting stories that can make their way into Hollywood. So, you know,
there's it's like both ends of the spectrum.
Exactly. So either Africans are pictured as being, you know, noble, uplifting human interest stories, or as terror-ridden subjects of genocidal political violence. And, you know, at a very basic level, you know, any Africa scholar will feel it to be an obligation to tell complex stories about the African past and about African politics. My own interest at the moment is animated by, you know, a desire to tell a story about how totalitarianism worked, about how dictatorships function, because I think it can help inform American politics today, quite frankly.
Yes.
A book about Idi Amin today bears, you know, it's not that Idi Amin is a kind of parallel with our own politics in the United States, but I think it's important that we would know how demagoguery functions, what happens to human idealism as it falls into the hands of totalitarian governments who try to turn it to their own interests, to target minorities and to make possible programs of action and reform that can be quite violent and destructive of interlaced multicultural human societies. So, you know, it's not that the Amin government is an object lesson for us, but I think it would be good if Americans did learn about the history of the Amin dictatorship as we enter, you know, as we're now at the outer edge of our own dangerous time in our politics today.
Amen to that, Derek. So the stories that you... Because you've curated a couple of stories to tell us today.
Yeah.
And you were actually, we were kind of at the break, we were kind of joking. This is a kooky story or so. But it's a real story, right? So this is part of like, is it too much to say like an everyday person in what they're attempting?
Well, look, I've got here
a big idea.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, much of the book is about ordinary people with big ideas who were found reasons for inspiration kind of at the margins of the Amin dictatorship. So I can tell you about one man who's the subject of one chapter named Peter Wankulu, who was a sugar cane. He worked on a sugar cane plantation in Jinja in the eastern part of Uganda, an otherwise anonymous fellow who in the 1960s develops an interest in Pan-Africanism, the ideology that is that African states ought to form a continental government that would draw all Africa together under a single centralized administration. his vision was like that of other African activists who pursued Pan-Africanism, Kwame Nkrumah and others, who imagined a kind of United States of Africa. That was the kind of goal. But Wankulu was a completely anonymous dude. He was just, he's kind of, you know, he's poor, he doesn't have much money, he never commands an audience. As far as I know, he's kind of a crank who labors away in a remote corner of Uganda's sugar economy, and yet who creates all of these beautiful collages which now appear in one of the district archives that I've been working in. The collages are produced by him in the 1970s as part of an effort to make visible alliances and possibilities that he thought Ugandans ought to conceive and make actionable in their own time. So I call him in the essay that I've just been writing here, it's a kind of cut-and-paste Pan-Africanism. He didn't rely on formal support from government or from the Organization of African Unity. He wasn't a newspaper editor. He didn't have professional printing equipment, didn't have a radio broadcasting booth. What was integral to all of his work was this sense of personal commitment. He worked with materials that came to hand, sellotape, glue, scissors, and photocopiers, to assemble the elements of a campaign that, in turn, inflected the cultural politics of Uganda in the mid-1970s. So, you know, today, Peter Wankulu is regarded in Uganda's politics as one of the founders of Pan-Africanism. In his own time, he was, as I said, a largely anonymous character who was a collage artist and who created these objects that he put up in the 1970s on public display.
Look, where would he put them, Derek? And what would one, can you describe like a visual of what one would kind of look like with a...
All right, let me read the opening paragraph of this chapter.
Okay.
Folded in the middle of an otherwise unremarkable file in the archives of Jinja District is a poster about 35 inches long and 25 inches wide, headed in hand-drawn letters, OAU Patriotic Volunteers. It's a visually arresting collage. There are photographs of eminent African leaders clipped out of newspapers, interspersed with short essays set in type or written by hand. On the left is a photo of Haile Selassie, founder of the Organization of African Unity. On the right is Jomo Kenyatta. In the middle is a photo of a building housing the headquarters of the OAU. All the photos are captioned in handwriting with inspirational statements. Below the photo of the OAU headquarters is written, "Mr. Nzo Ekangaki, OAU Secretary General, has a very big job." Toward the bottom right of the poster, there's a programmatic essay laying out the structure of a Union of African States. The first president is to be Ethiopia's head of state, Haile Selassie, assisted by Jomo Kenyatta. Tanzanian President Nyerere is to head the Ministry of Finance, associated with the president of Togo. Ugandan President Idi Amin is to head the Ministry of Communications, which is kind of hilarious. The poster's creator is this man named Peter Wankulu, an otherwise unremarkable clerk in the Kakira sugar plantation near Jinja. And he goes on, the essay goes on to describe Wankulu's biography and his reasons for investing in this effort to create in collage an image for a Pan-African government that might inspire Ugandans and African more generally toward Pan-African unification.
That's right. And so he was making the decisions about who was going to do what role.
That's right.
That's great.
Yes, that's right. I think Amin as Minister of Communications, for reasons we can talk about later, is just hilarious. But anyway.
Well, let's take a short break and then we'll come back. You've got Living Writers today on the program. Derek Peterson is here. We just were lucky enough to hear a section from Derek Peterson's future book on Idi Amin and Uganda and the people's history. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life. From jazz and cocktails, the girls I knew had sad and sullen gray faces with distant K-traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day 12 o'clock tales. Then you came along with your siren song to tempt me to madness. I thought for a while that your poignant smile
was tinged with the sadness of a great love for me. Again, I was wrong. Life is lonely again, and only last year everything seemed so sure.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, Derek Peterson is here. And that was just Johnny Hartman and John Coltrane. Did you want to say a couple words about Johnny Hartman, Derek? Or
yeah, no, I'm a tenor sax player myself and have always admired, you know, John Coltrane, who's the kind of paragon of tenor saxophone playing, you know, universally. Johnny Hartman and Coltrane got together in 1962 and did that album, we're told, in one take, although it's hard to imagine. It's such a lovely album. In my view, it's the best jazz album ever recorded. Such a fantastic, you know, piece of musicianship. So, you know, go check it out.
Thanks for choosing it for today. So when you were back, so you were an undergrad in Rochester.
Right.
And you did student radio then.
Yeah.
What was your...
WRUR, it was called. I was the jazz music director.
Figures. Is that when you actually, having access to all those albums, is that when you found a passion?
Yeah.
Did you already have it?
I was a saxophone player coming into Rochester. I had the good fortune to take lessons in the Eastman School of Music and played in jazz ensembles there. And, you know, Rochester in the 90s was a great place to be a student. Student radio there, as here at Michigan, is a great, you know, sort of platform to create interesting and exciting programs of the kind like you're doing here. I never tried anything like Living Writers, but it's amazing that you can sustain this kind of program over the course of time. But I have a lot of time for student radio as a space for idealism and to pursue interesting projects. Yeah.
And this connects now to part of the project that you're working on now is Ugandan radio. And Idi Amin.
Right. So one thing we haven't talked about that I've gotten sort of involved in is an effort to work out a way of preserving the audio and television archives of Radio Uganda, Uganda's national broadcaster, which went on the air in the early 1950s. The first broadcast was the coronation of Queen Elizabeth. It went on the air sort of over the airwaves. The early broadcasts were done across telephone lines. The signal was piped out to the provinces and put through amplifiers so people could listen to it. It went on the air over the airwaves in shortwave in the late 50s, 1958, I think. And over the course of the late 50s and 60s, Uganda developed the infrastructure for radio that was unparalleled in other parts of Africa. They had the strongest signal of any, the strongest transmitters, that is, of any radio station in Africa right through the 60s into 1971, when they went over to medium wave and started broadcasting into Europe. Idi Amin, in 1974, opened a station that could broadcast regularly to Europe and the United States. And so the archives of Uganda radio are full of listener reports. Back in the day, in the 70s and 80s, if you were a listener, you would fill in a form and send it off to the manager of the radio station to say, I've heard your signal. This is what was on the air. Can you please send me verification that I've, in fact, picked up your signal? It was something you did. There are dozens of these kinds of reports, probably hundreds, from places like Skokie, Illinois, and Japan, and Finland, lots of them from Germany. Uganda seems to have had a large listenership in Germany in the 1970s. People writing in with reports of what they heard. So I've gotten involved in an effort to figure out how to get the decaying 7 and 10 inch audio reels onto new media. We want them to be digitized. I've been working with colleagues at Uganda Radio, at the Uganda Broadcasting Corporation, to sort of assess the collection, there's a colleague here from the Duderstadt Center named Tom Bray, who's been
And of WCBN fame.
Yes, a friend of WCBN, I understand, too, who was with me in Kampala earlier this year, who helped to develop the kind of technical side of the project. And so in that, you know, in that context, I've become interested in the history of Radio Uganda as an enterprise and have folded it into this book about the 1970s because, as I said, the radio signal was so important in projecting an image of Uganda to international audiences and to local audiences that could find on the radio signal inspiration and direction and also kind of minatory, guidance on how to behave. Radio in the 1970s acted kind of as Twitter does in our own time. It was the vehicle that one used to get direct access to what the president thought. It was uncontrolled. Amin was always on the radio. The radio archives of Uganda Radio are full of hours-long addresses that Amin gave to the nation over the radio airwaves, preempting any other program, that are full of, you know, minutiae that he would broadcast over the airwaves, you know, telling so-and-so in that locality to knock it off, the contractor in Arua, you know, please change the design of the swimming pool. It's just an extraordinary range of stuff that Amin and other government officials used radio for. It's as though radio became the vehicle by which formerly bureaucracy had worked. That is, it was the vehicle for government communication, for the sort of the transference of minutiae to the provinces from the center. And as such, it was obligatory for every Ugandan to tune in the 1970s. If you were a local government official, you had to listen to the broadcast every evening to make sure you picked up exactly what the president said about some policy within your locality. And then you'd write it down and send out a circular to subordinate officials within your district to make sure they'd heard the radio broadcast so they acted in accordance with what the president wanted. That's how dictatorship worked.
And so he started as he meant to go on then, because as you said, when Obate was abroad, he went to the radio station and Idi Amin said, look, this is what's happening now.
Yeah, that's
I'm
right.
Here.
Yeah, there
over
was this,
the radio.
Exactly. There was this image of the radio. Radio was a new technology in Africa in the late 60s and 70s. You know, they'd been on the air in the 50s. But in the 60s, something like 8 out of every 10 Ugandans listened to the radio every day. And the number must have increased by the 1970s for reasons I've just described. So there was this presumption throughout, you know, all of government work in the 70s that radio was universally listened to, that even minute audiences could be addressed through the radio program because everybody was supposed to be listening in.
So did they then imagine it was beyond the Ugandan borders too? So that's why it was important to be beaming it to Japan, Germany, Skokie, Illinois, or
So the audiences addressed on the radio were ordinarily domestic audiences. The foreign programming was meant to project an image of virility and Pan-African energy to other countries around the world. Amin saw himself and was seen by many Africans as a kind of paragon of anti-colonial commitment in his own time. He was awarded the Malcolm X Award by an organization in this country called the Organization of African American Unity. He was feted by Stokely Carmichael and Miriam Makeba, who went to Uganda and got Ugandan passports from his
hand.
So
complicated, isn't it?
Yes. There was a time up to really the mid-1970s when Amin was a kind of forward-looking exemplar of what African leadership ought to look like. And African Americans particularly saw him as a kind of model
connecting
of how African politics ought to go. So the radio programming was part of this kind of international campaign to place Ugandan politics at the center of things. Amin was very convinced that he was president not of a remote and unimportant country, but he was president of a place that was at the center of everything. So he felt free. You know, he addressed himself to Richard Nixon about Watergate, sent very specific advice about how to deal with American politics. He sent constant correspondence to Britain, commenting on minute matters of British politics, telegrams to Golda Meir in Israel about the Israeli conflict with the Palestinians. There's a kind of comic aspect to this, but it's also, there's something quite kind of inspiring about it, too, this sense that you know, that Africa was not, in fact, a provincial place, but in fact that there was something to be learned from the Ugandan experience that other world leaders ought to benefit from, which is true.
Which is true. And what is what your work is centering around and the Africa Studies Center, African Studies Center here at UM and in Cambridge, where you were before.
Yeah.
Right? Like this is...
No, indeed. There's a lot to admire, really, about the Amin government, even as one also worries about, you know, and, you know, is horrified by the demagoguery, as I mentioned earlier, the pursuit of dissident minorities, the violence.
Yes.
One also has to, you also as a scholar have to recognize that there was a lot that people could get inspired about in the Amin government, in the ideological commitments that people held, which drew inspiration from the example of Amin's war against colonialism, his commitment to Black economic advancement. These were things that lots of people could get behind, really. Yeah. And radio was central to all of that.
Well, we do love our radio here.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming and talking with me today, Derek. I've so appreciated
it. Sure.
Come back anytime.
Pleasure. Okay. Thank you for having me, T, again.
And so today, on today's program, Derek Peterson, we've had the books Creative Writing, Translation, Bookkeeping, and the Work of Imagination in Colonial Kenya on the table with us. And also... Pilgrim's Politics,
yes,
or Ethnic Patriotism and the East African Revival, A History of Dissent. And we've got an upcoming book to look forward to by Derek Peterson. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Balada feye kunyimage, ajakunda damarima. Babu de fedo mama sire dinke ye kunyimage.
WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Another hour of music.
It is now time for the Daily Jazzy Report in place of the Daily Sports Report, which I believe is done for the semester and possibly this summer. My name's Sarah Min, and here is some Alice Coltrane.